tennis ball, like this one here. Or for a minute, just imagine grabbing a tennis ball and giving it a solid squeeze. Do it again. And again. Keep going. If you did 30 reps like this, that'd be a pretty good hand exercise. Now, how about 100,000 reps? Each time your heart beats, it exerts about the same amount of force as you squeezing that tennis ball, and your heart beats about 100,000 times a day.
This is the UW Medicine Pulse with Marty Reamer. Real-world stories of the discoveries being made at UW Medicine and the impact they're having on people here in the Pacific Northwest and around the world.
...100,000 squeezes a day, 2.5 billion in a lifetime. That is quite a workout for the heart muscle. And it does it with clock-like regularity. Actually, it's better than a clock because a clock always ticks at 60 beats a minute. But the heart can vary its rate depending on level of exercise or your emotions or fever. Now, there are conditions that disrupt those normal heart rhythms.
Of course, atrial fibrillation is one of the most common cardiac arrhythmias.
Atrial fibrillation, also known as AFib for short, is one of the most common cardiac arrhythmias. Arrhythmias, meaning something that disrupts the normal beating of the heart.
And when you say cardiac arrhythmia, we're usually talking about an electrical problem of the heart. Now,
Dr. Nazem Akum, an electrophysiologist at the Regional Heart Center at UW Medical Center. Electrophysiology deals with the electrical activities of the heart because the heart is a muscle that's regulated by tiny electrical signals. And when they get knocked out of whack, the heart's rhythm falters, as is the case with atrial fibrillation.
So atrial fibrillation is a very descriptive term. It actually means that the upper chambers of the heart are quivering or fibrillating, shaking rather than squeezing. And this absence of the normal squeeze takes a little bit of the efficiency with which the heart works. So that's where the symptoms sometimes come from, especially the fatigue and the shortness of breath.
Right now, somewhere between 2 and 5 million Americans are affected by AFib. A lot of people have it and don't know it, so it's hard to pin that number down.
It's something that's common with age. The prevalence of AFib increases as we get older, and it becomes even more prevalent once we have other cardiovascular problems.
One person who does have it, knows it, and has launched a campaign to let other people know about it, is Saturday Night Live actor, comedian, Kevin Nealon.
Once again, I am Hans.
And I am Franz, and we just want to pop you off.
Yes, that Kevin Nealon.
Yeah, that's right. Wake up and smell the muscles.
A lot of people don't know they have it,
right,
because it's very slight, and it's a slight irregular heartbeat. But for me, it kind of was like a pack of horses running.
Some patients don't feel it at all. Some patients can tell when their heart is in this arrhythmia by the pattern with which it beats. So they could tell that their heart's irregular or fast.
My heart starts running away, like a pack of horses.
Sometimes they feel something in their chest. Most commonly they describe it as butterflies. Some people say it's like a fish is flip-flopping in there.
You know, but and I always tell people, I say, if you think you are susceptible, go check with your doctor about.
While that arrhythmia, if you can feel it at all, can be unsettling or alarming, it's not something that will make the heart stop. So it's not the same thing as a heart attack.
So it's different in that sense from ventricular arrhythmias, which can be life-threatening and can cause people to collapse in sudden cardiac death from those kinds of arrhythmias. So AFib is not like that.
No, in fact, the biggest risk with AFib is not to the heart, but to the brain.
The quivering motion or that fibrillation can sometimes cause a blood clot to form inside the heart. And that's why this arrhythmia is also considered a major risk factor for a stroke.
So is that the primary danger?
This is probably the thing that I fear the most with atrial fibrillation. So one of the key decisions that we have to make when we're caring for patients with atrial fibrillation is to try to estimate their risk of stroke and try to minimize that risk.
Besides trying to avoid those blood clots that are sometimes caused by AFib episodes, there's another reason to treat this condition.
Sometimes, and especially at the onset when you start developing AFib, the episodes start and stop on their own, without us doing anything, neither a drug or an electrical shock or anything. But if you leave it untreated, the natural course is for those episodes to become gradually longer and more frequent, to the point where patients sometimes will go into AFib and just stay in it. There's a chance of developing heart failure. So we don't like to keep patients in AFib and their hearts racing for hours and days on end. Plus, you know, they don't feel very good.
Let's rewind the tape here and play back something Dr. Akum just said.
There's a chance of developing heart failure.
He uses the term heart failure there, which is a term you hear used quite frequently. And I wonder if people really understand what that term means, heart failure.
So generally, heart failure is not a diagnosis, but it's a clinical syndrome, meaning there's a number of different things that can cause it.
That's Dr. Claudius Marr, a UW Medicine cardiologist specializing in advanced heart failure.
It's a very common condition. And the end result is the heart is either unable to pump blood efficiently or unable to fill the way it's supposed to.
No, heart failure is not one distinct event, and it's not the same thing as a heart attack.
There's obviously a distinction between a heart attack and heart failure. Does a heart attack lead to heart failure? Is that how that would work?
In many patients, heart attacks, especially if they're large, significant heart attacks, over time will lead to heart failure. And the reason, in part, of why we're seeing an increase in the prevalence of heart failure is because medical therapy has gotten much better for heart attacks, things like that. So people are surviving, thankfully, their heart attacks. But over time, then, the heart becomes weakened and enlarged and, in some cases, barely able to keep up.
Heart failure.
It ranges from patients who have asymptomatic, almost subclinical disease presentations to patients who develop fatigue, shortness of breath, fill up with fluid, retaining fluid in their body, to patients that are so sick that really their vital organs are not receiving adequate blood supply. And those are the patients that require blood pumps, heart transplantation, things like that, on the other extreme of the spectrum.
Heart failure.
It cannot be cured. Even if the heart function improves over time, it doesn't ever go back to being perfect the way it was before. There are some patients who have a significant amount of what we call a reverse remodeling. The heart gets better, stronger over time with medical therapy, and that's, of course, what we aim for in everybody. But unfortunately, that doesn't happen in everybody. Despite our best efforts, some patients continue to progress and deteriorate over time.
Any good news on the horizon? Anything that's being worked on either here at UW Medicine or elsewhere that's improving the outlook for these patients?
Yes, University of Washington is actually one of the international leaders in this field, and we have incredibly talented scientists working on anything ranging from understanding the mechanisms of heart failure to developing better therapy to mechanical blood pumps that take over for the failing heart, to heart transplantation for patients that are failing every other forms of therapy, to stem cell therapy for heart failure.
And taking lessons from developmental biology, we were able to figure out the chemical signals.
Last year, we did a fascinating show on stem cells and how this group of UW Medicine researchers were using stem cells to regenerate damaged heart tissue.
Really an oh wow moment when we saw our first dishes of essentially sheets of beating human heart muscle. And then the realization.
These scientists were in the lab trying to coax stem cells into becoming beating heart tissue, and they were doing it.
There it's coming into focus.
That's amazing.
Isn't that cool? This is several thousand heart muscle cells we're looking at this magnification. So we
can... When I looked into that microscope at the beating heart tissue, which had been grown from stem cells, well, you don't need to be a scientist to imagine the possibilities. If we could figure out a way to have the human heart accept and assimilate those cells, well, then you've basically figured out a way to repair a damaged heart, to reverse heart disease.
So we started off with transplant station studies in rats.
What we learned in that episode from Dr. Chuck Murray and his partners at UW Medicine was that the research was progressing. It was going from the lab dish to rats to guinea pigs.
Each step we were increasing the complexity of the model and increasing the number of cells we had to generate.
The idea that one could use laboratory-derived heart tissue to repair a damaged heart muscle is evolving.
Right. It's what we call translational research.
Dr. Creighton Dawn.
Basically translating what's been discovered in the basic science labs and in the animal models and really applying it to human beings or more applicable to clinical applications.
Dr. Creighton Dawn is an interventional cardiologist at UW Medicine who's involved in making that transition, going from the lab.
They're focused on is really understanding what's the right cell and how does it work on a basic biologic level.
And translating that knowledge, those discoveries, to people.
Whenever you translate that into adults, it becomes much more complicated because, you know, adults aren't, genetically similar mice. We all are very different. And I think that's part of what I'm trying to understand too. Like, what are the appropriate patients that would respond to this type of therapy? There was an interesting study performed a couple years ago where they looked at stem cells, adult stem cells in patients who were older than 62 and younger than 62. And they found that the benefit that they saw in the overall trial is really driven by the younger patients. That there seems to be either it was the receiving tissue was more amenable to the stem cell therapy or the cells that were taken from these patients were better cells.
Finding the right patients that could benefit from this type of stem cell procedure and developing the best way to deliver those stem cells, that's where Dr. Dawn focuses a large part of his energy.
What we found in the early studies is that if you just take a cell and inject it down the coronary artery into the bloodstream of the heart, that the cell will have maybe a 10% chance of going into the heart, but most of the cells kind of get washed out and are eventually taken out of the circulation, so don't really end up in the target tissue. We found that if you just inject it in a vein peripherally, that less than 1% of those cells go to the heart. We know that if you inject it directly with a needle into the heart, even then it has a yield of only about 10 to 50%. A lot of these cells wash out, or because you're forcefully injecting the cell into the host tissue, that it may not have the chance to engraft or to survive in that situation. So what I'm interested in pushing forward are the methods for delivering the cells and determine the optimal methods for delivering and getting the highest yield for these cells. And that's something that I've looked at with these animal studies. We're also looking at different catheters. So this is the cath lab team. On the screen, you see the TE probe, which is a black line going down. That's an echocardiogram, and that's what Peter in the back there, he's the anesthesiologist, he's using to kind of look at the heart. I don't see his images are back there. It's on his screen in the back. You can actually see close echocardiogram of the heart.
So Peter, can you show us the echo again?
That's what the heart function is.
Okay.
What you're seeing on the screen there are just our catheters and wires, and that's how we kind of guide our devices to the different parts of the heart. So.
The cath lab. This is the clinical space where, when the time is right, those lab-developed heart cells, that heart tissue, would get injected into a patient's damaged heart muscle.
When I do my stem cell injections in adults, it's in the same sort of lab, the same situation,
okay.
With fluoroscopy and these injections.
So the science continues to advance, but the question everyone always wants answered is how and when does this research begin to benefit the public at large?
Right now, we've gotten very good at opening heart arteries. If someone has a heart attack due to a closed artery, we can get in there, we can open things up, we can improve the blood flow to that part of the heart. What we haven't gotten good at in several patients is that even though there's blood flow to that part of the heart, that heart's not functioning because there's too much scar tissue or because the cells are dysfunctional. So the dream would be that we can, in those patients where they have good blood supply but not good function because of scar tissue, that we can go in and develop a cell or a therapy, a biologic, or some drug that's going to reduce that scar and improve the heart function. I mean, I think that would be the dream in 20 years. But I do think that, when we move to phase 1, phase 2, and sometimes phase 3 studies, there is a potential for direct benefit to the patient from the therapies themselves. And for these type of therapies, they're geared at patients who have no other options, typically, and where the other option is either hospice or palliative care or this therapy. And I think that given the small chance that there may be some benefit, I think that certainly, as a benefit to the public. So.
So what does all this mean for you? The Regional Heart Center at UW Medicine has become renowned in this region and around the globe in treating cardiac conditions, bringing together a myriad of heart-related specialties to treat some of the most complex cases. Cardiologist Dr. Claudius Marr.
It's incredibly rewarding to take somebody who otherwise has no hope, no choice, many times has been told that this is it and there's nothing else that can be done for them, and see them over the next 5, 10, 15, 20, 25 years thriving after their heart transplant. That's incredibly rewarding, and that's part of the reason why we're able to do what we do day in and day out.
The Regional Heart Center, as in all of UW Medicine, is also unique in this region in how it's always pushing the frontiers of medicine, trying to overcome all the challenges that exist, for instance, with using stem cells to repair damaged heart muscle. And if this all seems very sci-fi and supernatural, it's not, as is evidenced by the very real people like Dr. Creighton Dawn who are doing the work.
You know, sometimes I go out and I see, you know, young people laughing and enjoying time in the bar, and I'm just always amazed at, you know, that they're breathing and living and so healthy. And on one hand, it drives me to get better, you know, to be a better physician, to really push the field forward with, you know, research, but also to learn to appreciate, you know, life in general.
I want to thank Drs. Creighton Dawn, Claudius Marr, and Nazem Akum for joining us today on the UW Medicine Pulse podcast. If you'd like more information about any of the topics you heard about on today's program, the Regional Heart Center at UW Medicine and their methods of treating atrial fibrillation and other diseases of the heart, or the stem cell work being advanced here, visit uwmedicine.org/pulse. And please subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, UW Medicine Pulse, to get every episode delivered to your phone or tablet as soon as they are released. UW Medicine Pulse is produced by Tina Knoll, associate producer Aaron Gervais. I'm Marty Reamer. Thanks for listening.